People are actually losing their homes and asking to rent in our apartments.
The biggest obstacle is, of course, lack of funds.
We think we've helped 58,000 people.
We're constantly having a greater demand for affordable housing.
Welcome to the Affordable Housing Podcast, brought to you by Eden Housing.
What would you say if I told you that a gigaton of greenhouse gas emission can be eliminated through behavior change? I'm guessing you'd want to join the bandwagon and support efforts to get people to change their behavior. Hi, I'm Joanne Green, and on this episode of Eden Housing's Affordable Housing Podcast, we'll be focusing on the Climate, Buildings, and Behavior Project at the Garrison Institute in New York. CBB helps real estate developers, managers, and owners utilize knowledge from the neurobehavioral and social sciences in order to design effective energy consumption behavior change programs. Here's a statistic that might surprise you. Buildings account for 42% of all U.S. GHG emissions. Therefore, reducing occupant energy consumption through behavior change can significantly reduce the carbon footprint of buildings. Recent studies have shown that simply giving office building occupants a web page where they can track their energy usage can lead to a 15% reduction in individual usage. When given feedback, college students, for instance, reduce their energy usage by between 12 and 40%. Our guest today is Dr. Karen Earhart Martinez. She directs the CBB project at the Garrison Institute and is also a senior research associate in the sociology department at Colorado State University. She has 20 years of experience in applied and academic research with a focus on the social and behavioral dimensions of energy and climate change. She's co-founder of the Behavior, Energy, and Climate Change Conference, and among her recent accomplishments is an edited volume on the social and behavioral dimensions of energy and climate change entitled People-Centered Initiatives for Increasing Energy Savings. Welcome, Karen.
Hi, Joanne. I really appreciate the opportunity to be on the call today.
Excellent. Let's start out with a brief overview on CBB, what it is and what you're trying to promote in relation to climate change.
Yeah, so the Climate Buildings and Behavior Program is a very unique approach because what we try to do is work with building owners, operators, and managers to really get a better idea of how to engage people in energy and carbon savings. And we do that by bringing social, behavioral, and cognitive science and research to bear on these questions. So we look across these different fields of science and look for important insights that they have to offer in how to really engage people in addressing these issues. And we share those and provide those in meaningful ways through this symposia and other events to really enhance the effectiveness of the efforts that are going on in the building sector, whether residential or even non-residential.
So why is it so important to encourage behavior change? Is it really going to make a difference?
Well, you know, that's a great question because historically, when we have, as a society, have tried to address energy issues, we've primarily focused our attention on coming up with better technologies. The better refrigerator, it operates in the same way using less energy, but And those strategies have actually paid off enormously, but as we all know, those, you know, replacing technologies can be very expensive. On the other hand, I've been involved in research, as have several other researchers in the social science field, looking at what is the potential energy savings and carbon savings that can come from relatively simple behavioral changes. And what we found is that those kinds of changes can actually reduce energy consumption by 20 to 30% in the residential sector specifically.
Education is so much a part of this, isn't it?
Education is really important, but we find that their information is only part of the process. So helping people by providing them with the tools that they need, the information that they need, is an incredibly important part of the process. But in a lot of cases, we also, again, have to bring a variety of social science insights to bear to really translate that information into action, which tends to be the more challenging part of the equation.
Garrison also runs a climate change program focused on cities. Can you talk about that program, who participates in it, and what you hope to accomplish?
Sure, yeah. And, of course, buildings are part of cities, so that this is all interrelated. But the cities program is focused on working with city sustainability managers, urban planners, and other city leaders to do this kind of work on a bit broader scale. So instead of just working, and I should say that even our work at the buildings level is not typically focused simply on individual buildings, but with organizations like Eden Housing, who are in charge of a whole portfolios of buildings. And so that allows us to scale up the effort. And similarly with cities, we are able to work at what I call this certain unit of social aggregation, which is, you know, a municipality, and try to affect change across different organizations within that municipality.
Karen, I understand that your research looks at behavior change in several specific cities where events triggered some sort of substantial collective action. Can you talk about Juneau, Alaska, and what the people there learned when they lost their main power line to an avalanche?
Yeah, actually, so that builds on some really interesting research that has actually been spearheaded by a researcher named Alan Meyer from Lawrence Berkeley National Lab and University of California. And he has done some very interesting research that most of which is collected in a volume called Saving Electricity in a Hurry, where he looks at a variety of different crisis situations in countries around the world, energy crisis situations, and the effect that they've had on electricity consumption. In the case of Juneau, this is a relatively recent event where an avalanche cut their main transmission lines. And so they found themselves having to rely on a limited amount of electricity that was generator produced as opposed to their original source of power, which was hydroelectric. So this was very expensive and very limited amounts of electricity that really caused the entire city to stop and think about what they could actually do to maintain their standard of living, but also dramatically reduce the amount of electricity that they were consuming. And within a six-week period, they were able to reduce their electricity consumption by 40%. And as you can imagine, which is absolutely incredible.
That's huge.
Yeah, exactly. 40%, because when you think about it, what can you do in 6 weeks? You're not going to go in and make huge changes in the technology and in the infrastructure. So, you know, we know, and as a matter of fact, follow-up research has confirmed that most of these savings were, in fact, achieved through simple changes in the way that people were using electricity and with small technology changes like using CFLs. So, you know, it really is, I think, very dramatic evidence of the kinds of savings that can be achieved in very short time periods. Now, of course, having said that, you know, after the crises, after this particular crisis was averted and the power lines were restored, not surprisingly, electricity consumption did, you know, rebound a bit, but they were able to maintain a 10% energy savings or electricity savings even after the crisis was over.
You know, it's so interesting. Our best selves tend to come out after a crisis or during, you know, the immediate aftermath. I'm thinking about 9/11 and how cooperative we all were, how kind we all were to one another, and then slowly our old behaviors start to creep in. Generally, it seems people are slow to change their behaviors when there isn't an immediate reward or incentive. Can you talk about the barriers and incentives that seem to make a difference in the effort to conserve energy?
Yeah, I think one of the biggest barriers is that invisibility of our modern energy resources, particularly when we think about the energy that we use in our homes, because, you know, mostly we're talking about natural gas and electricity. And, you know, if you compare that to 100 years ago when we were, you know, heating our homes, we'd have to go out and chop wood to do that or, you know, shovel coal. And it was we had this much more direct connection to our energy resources than we do today. And, you know, if we think about how we know how much energy we consume today, well, first of all, most of us don't. But to the degree to which we do, it's only because we get a bill at the end of the month. And, you know, this is not a very effective way of really creating a level of mindfulness about our energy consumption. There's this great analogy that's been used for decades now about the problematic nature of our modern energy system and the fact, you know, it's akin to if we were to go grocery shopping and fill up our cart and no individual item had a price associated with it, but we got to the checkout and they told us what we owed, but we didn't know which of the things in our cart were more expensive and which of the things were less expensive, and we just simply got the bill at the end of the month. So we wouldn't really know how to reduce the cost of our grocery bill. And the same thing happens with our modern energy, because if you think about electricity in particular, there are so many what people in the industry call end uses. In other words, we use that electricity for so many different things, from, you know, our computers and televisions and refrigerators to air conditioning to a myriad of small things that include, you know, hair dryers and cell phone chargers and coffee makers. So it becomes really difficult for people to really get a sense for what is really driving those the level of consumption that they have, even if they're aware of what that level is. So that's a huge barrier.
I have to tell you, I'm feeling a little badly right now because I've been awake for only about a half an hour and I've used almost every one of those items that you mentioned. The coffee maker, the cell phone charger, the hair dryer.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I mean, you know, that's our normal lifestyle, and there's nothing wrong with that. It's so invisible to us that it's hard to even be mindful of what our energy use practices are on a daily basis. And so that's one of the reasons why a lot of the new feedback devices have been shown to be very effective. So feedback can take a lot of different forms, and you mentioned this in the opening statement that you made. You know, anywhere from monthly things that are called home energy reports that sort of break down some of those items to real-time feedback that we might receive through a monitor in our homes that you know allows us to see how much electricity that we're consuming. And the really interesting thing about the real-time feedback, and maybe this won't be surprising to you, but I thought it was very interesting when I learned this, that, you know, when people are able to see in real time how much electricity they are using, one of the first things they do is they go around and they start turning things on and off, right, to see what kind of impact it's actually having on their electricity consumption. And as a result of that, they become the experts. They're able to educate themselves and to learn about the impact that these practices, these everyday practices like drying your hair, actually have and how they contribute to your energy footprint or your carbon footprint.
No, I think it makes sense in that it's empowering people. I think
exactly.
Right? So giving them an article to read is one thing. They read it, but they're not involved.
Right.
That's
exactly right.
Right. They haven't actually gotten that information. So what would giving everyone a smart meter do? Would that really make a difference, you think?
Well, so this is another really interesting thing, because smart meters, people are generally confused about what smart meters are. I mean, maybe people in California are more aware. It's certainly gotten a lot more attention there. But when people think about the smart grid and smart meters, I've done some focus group research on this across the country, and there is this misperception that when you get a smart meter in your home, that it will automatically give you this kind of information. But that's not, in fact, true. What it does collect that information, and it does provide it to the utilities, but without the feedback device, whether it's on a computer or in your home, there are a whole variety of them that are emerging every day that take different forms. But without that device that communicates that information to the homeowner or to the renter, to the occupant. The smart meter alone is just not sufficient to provide that level of engagement with the data and to really allow for that learning experience and for the changes associated with that that people often make in their lives.
So, you know, most homeowners with an awareness of energy resources would love to conserve if there wasn't that big initial output. I would love, for instance, to have solar panels on my home, but the cost stops me. And then I'm thinking about things like changing windows and major appliances. They still come with a significant price tag. So can you talk about that continuum of behavior change? I know you've done some research in California in this area.
So one way to think about the different types of things that people can do to reduce their energy consumption is to think about it using a typology that, if you think about a 2x2 matrix, where the one axis is the cost of the shift, whether it's what I would call a no-cost or low-cost behavior, and the other one being a larger cost or what you might call an investment, and then the other axis being the sort of level of mindfulness and repetition, how frequently do you have to engage in that behavior? We can think about the fact that there are three categories of behavior, if you will. The least expensive but most frequent types of behaviors we might call routines or habits, and those are the kinds of things that we engage in on a regular basis. So it can be, you know, the length of your showers that you take once or twice a day for a lot of people, or how you run your clothes washer or your dishwasher, for example. A second kind of behavior are the things that are also low cost, no cost, but that are less frequent. So we call these stock-taking behaviors, things where you have to stop periodically and think about, have I replaced that furnace filter, and you know, what kind of impact can that have? This is a transportation example, but am I inflating my tires properly? Am I making sure that those are inflated? And particularly when you live in a place that does have different seasons over the course of the year, where you have important changes in weather and temperature, you know, you need to be thinking as you switch from air conditioning to heating, are my windows sealed? And, you know, is it time to put away those window fans and things of that nature? And then the last category is more the investment category. So those are things like, you know, replacing your windows or getting those Energy Star appliances in your kitchen or putting in more insulation. And it really is a continuum in terms of the amount of investment and the whether or not you're engaged in these activities every day or on a less frequent basis.
Karen, how do you organize a green behavior change initiative? Is a strategy like this limited to a building, or could it apply to a whole neighborhood or even a whole city?
Yeah, I mean, it really is a question of what is your position in that larger spectrum, but it can take place on any of those levels. I mean, I know, you know, people, and as a matter of fact, it doesn't even have to exist in a specific geographic space. People are doing this sort of work in online communities as well. So whether you're trying to do it in your family, you can, you know, people are engaged at that level. You could be organizing it in an entire building level if you're in an apartment complex or a condo, or, you know, it also is happening at the city level as well. Lots of cities have sustainability officers that are, in, you know, looking into this and developing programs, and they're very interested in working with the city residents in order to accomplish that. And that's happening not just at the residential level, but again, citywide. So I'm currently involved in a program that's looking at, you know, what New York City is doing. And of course, New York City is one of our largest cities, but they have made very large investments in improving the energy and carbon footprint of their city, as have many, many cities around the country.
How do you measure the success of behavior change initiatives?
Well, that's a really difficult question, and it's a big challenge. The interesting thing is that so many people think that it is so much harder to measure change associated with behavior than it is technology. But in fact, that is really largely a myth. I mean, we tend to think that if we put in a new air conditioner, that that it's a simple calculation to figure out how much energy is actually being saved as a result of that. But often, it's very difficult to predict exactly how it's going to perform in a particular house given a particular set of occupants and the particular behaviors in which they're actually engaging in. And so the real question is, how do people interact with their technologies? I always like to think about technologies simply as tools for people. And so technologies don't really exist in a vacuum and separate from the people that use them. So we have to think about the intersection of people and technology and how people work in the built environment and with the technologies that are part of that environment. Measuring that kind of change is, to a large degree, simply a function of getting the energy bill at the end of the month and seeing how it's changed, and then finding the right ways to attribute those savings to different levels of initiative. So ideally, you would set it up as an experimental design, but in reality, a lot of these initiatives don't have the luxury to do that because they're not interested, for example, in how much energy any one single action might be able to achieve, but instead they're trying to maximize their savings, and as a result, they're implementing several different types of initiatives at the same time.
Karen, if you had a policy wish list that would help create an incentive for behavior change, what would you put on that list?
Oh, wow. That's a really good question. I'm going to have to actually write down what that list is. But, I mean, there are a lot of policy types of changes that can really facilitate behavior change. I've done a lot of research on feedback, and so it's a topic that's very important to me. And I would say probably at the top of my list would be that every household should have that information available to them, especially as the smart grid continues to be put into place around the country. There's no reason why this information shouldn't be provided to people. It's their right to have this information available to them because the utilities are, you know, as they roll out the smart grid, the utilities increasingly have this information, and they should be sharing it with people. And we've already discussed how important that is in shifting behavior. There are a lot of other things that can be implemented. There are a lot of financing schemes that can be put into place to help lower the cost of technologies, energy efficiency technologies, the ones that you mentioned that are often out of the price range that most people can afford, whether it's new windows or more insulation or new appliances, a new furnace, a new air conditioner. These things are important when we think about, like you said, buildings comprise over 40% of our energy use and carbon emissions in this country. And when we think about how huge that is and the fact that there are a lot of things that we can be doing, like making it more affordable for people to make those improvements, we should definitely be doing that. And there are some schemes like that in place where people can tie the cost of those investments to the value of their homes, so that the cost can be spread out over long periods of time. That's one example. Another great policy would be to make the energy footprint and the operating footprint of a particular home also more apparent by doing energy scorecards for residences, so that you know going in that it's not just the cost of rent that you have to pay for when you live in a particular home, but, you know, there's also the important operating costs, and energy is a big part of that. And so making that more obvious when people are making those decisions would also go a long way.
Karen, thank you so much for all this work that you do and for sharing your insights with us today.
Oh, well, thank you. It's my pleasure, and I really appreciate this opportunity.
Dr. Karen Earhart Martinez directs the Climate Buildings and Behavior Project at the Garrison Institute. If you'd like to see videos of some of the presentations at the symposia that the Garrison Institute has presented, they are all archived on the Garrison Institute website, and that's garrisoninstitute.org. For Eden Housing, I'm Joanne Green. And for more information, please visit edenhousing.org.
SmarterPodcasts.com. Delivering sound advice.